As the sports announcer of yesteryear used to say, let's get ready to rumble. That's not exactly a rumble that we're in for in this episode, so much as a tumble into the rabbit hole of theological wrangling that took place after the Council of Chalcedon that led to the Second and Third Councils of Constantinople in the years 553 and 680. And it all goes back to the debate over the nature of Jesus that was supposed to be resolved at the Council of Ephesus in 431. And wait, you say, didn't the council at Chalcedon that we looked at in the last episode clear all that up? Well, we thought so, but it turns out some bishops and many of the common people, they weren't happy with the conclusions of Chalcedon. They said that the wording of the now revised Nicene Creed wasn't sufficiently clear. It left room for error. By the beginning of the 6th century, the Church of the East, which was centered in Persia, had by this time adopted the idea that Jesus wasn't just two natures. He was two persons, one divine, the other human. Now, we're not going to get into the intricacies of that theology since it would take us on a tangent. But the upshot is, the Orthodox churches of East and West had already drawn a line over which they had set the Nestorian Church of the East as heretics. It's no wonder, then, that the Nestorians rejected both the councils of Ephesus and Chalcedon. But it wasn't just the Church of the East that rejected Chalcedon. A growing number of groups along the Mediterranean coast, in Syria, Egypt, Palestine, and then inland in Armenia, that also rejected Chalcedon. These groups were Monophysites, that is, they believed that Jesus possessed a single divine nature, as opposed to the dual nature of human and divine that had been settled on at the Council of Chalcedon. But then there were different groups of Monophysites who arrived at their belief in a single divine nature of Christ by different routes. One group said that Jesus did indeed have two natures as God and man, but that his deity utterly overwhelmed his humanity. Another group said that in Jesus, the divine and the human natures were fused into a new third hybrid nature, and they preferred to be called Miaphysites. So the church was split in three segments: the Nestorian Church of the East, which of course was outside the empire, and then the Nicene Chalcedonians, along with the non-Chalcedonian Monophysites, who were inside the empire. The Second Council at Constantinople, that was an attempt to reconcile the Chalcedonians, who believed in the Nicene Creed, and the Monophysites, by once more condemning Nestorianism and putting the language of Chalcedon in a more acceptable form for the Monophysites. Now, before we get to the council, we need to talk a bit about some writings that had been making the rounds that were called the Three Chapters. In 551, which is 2 years before he called the Second Council of Constantinople, the Emperor Justinian issued an edict condemning a collection of writings that supported what Nestorius had really taught about the nature of Christ, rather than the misrepresentation of his critics. Now, these works were a thorough examination of the errors of Monophysitism. They were known as the Three Chapters, and they kept the whole Christological controversy alive by calling into question the validity of both the councils of Ephesus and Chalcedon. Justinian decided to shut the controversy down by just passing an edict condemning the Three Chapters. But you know what happens when the man at the top tells people not to read or heed something, right? It only makes people curious. And the more who read the Three Chapters, the more they concluded that the councils had erred in condemning Nestorius while honoring his opponent, Cyril. So, Justinian called a new ecumenical council for May of 553, hoping to reconcile the recalcitrant Monophysites with the Chalcedonians by making clear his imperial dismissal of Nestorianism. Now, the council was presided over by Eutychius, the Patriarch of Constantinople. The Roman Pope Vigilius was invited, and as circumstances would have it, since he was in Constantinople at the time, it was assumed that he would attend. He'd had to flee there for refuge from the rampaging Ostrogoths in his native Italy, but Vigilius declined attending the council and issued a statement forbidding it proceeding without his authorization. What he was upset about was the fact that a council was called and he was not the one who called it. From his thinking, as the Pope of Rome, it was up to him to call councils. Well, the other bishops ignored his lack of being there. They went right ahead with it. They condemned the Three Chapters, and in the seventh session that they held, they had Pope Vigilius's name stricken from the official list of names with whom the bishops recognized legitimacy. By this action, they excommunicated the Pope for his refusal to appear at the council. Vigilius was then imprisoned in Constantinople by Justinian. His advisors were exiled, and 6 months later, Vigilius agreed to condemn the three chapters, claiming that he had been misled by those now exiled advisors. He then approved the council's work. Now, the council had hammered out a compromise that they thought would, well, it would uphold the conclusions of the Council of Chalcedon while addressing Monophysite concerns. In reality, all it did was make clear to the Monophysites that their beliefs about the nature of Christ weren't kosher. They weren't going to be accepted. To this day, the Syriac, Armenian, and Coptic Orthodox churches reject the Council of Chalcedon and this Second Council of Constantinople and maintain their tradition of being Monophysite. The theological rift morphed into a political breach when these regions refused to honor the rule of the Eastern capital. They were then subsumed under the Islamic Caliphate a century later. When news of the council's treatment of the Pope and its refined creed reached the Western churches, many dioceses rejected it and only came to a begrudged acceptance after a couple of centuries. And that brings us to the Sixth Ecumenical Council, also held in Constantinople 130 years after the Second Council of Constantinople. And since it was also held in the Eastern capital, it's called the Third Council of Constantinople. Because the Chalcedonian-Nicene Monophysite rift wasn't sealed, a new idea about the nature of Christ was proposed. And this time, it dealt with Jesus' will. You see, the question was asked, if Jesus is one person with two natures, as the Chalcedonian Creed said, and the last council affirmed, how many wills does he have, one or two? Now, not surprisingly, Monophysites said that because Jesus' divinity completely overshadowed his humanity, he had a single will. And because theologians just love to make up new words, this was called monotheletism, from the Greek word for will, thelema. Now, to be fair, let me clarify and say that monotheletists, and you try saying that, agreed that Jesus did indeed have a human will, but it was dormant. It was inactive in a kind of, well, spiritual hibernation. Adherents to this doctrine hoped that it would, well, prove an end to the long-running controversy over the natures of Jesus. He retained two natures and two wills, but the human was subordinated to his divine. Utterly so. For monotheletists, there was no question about how Christ experienced his life in the incarnation as a person. This doctrine was prompted by Sergius and a group of dedicated theologians. It had the enthusiastic backing of Emperor Heraclius, who hoped that it was a way to mend the breach between Chalcedonian Nicenes and the Monophysites. This issue of how many wills Jesus had may be one of the more obscure debates in church history. As we've seen in previous episodes, early church fathers were concerned that if Christ was not completely human, humanity couldn't be completely redeemed. Monotheletists said that Christ was completely human, but that his divine will had taken over such mundane tasks as eating and drinking and other activities that engaged the physical realm. Set over against the monotheletists were the, are you ready for another tongue twister? The Diophilites, who said that Jesus had two co-equal wills, one human and the other divine. They argued that it's pointless to say that Jesus is fully human, but then got him of one of the prime characteristics that makes a human human, not a mere animal. And that's the will, the power to make real moral choices. Diophilites were led by a theologian named Maximus. He said the divine and the human wills of Jesus worked in concert. The human was submitted to the divine, but not at all subsumed in some kind of dormant state. The human will was every bit as active as the divine, but was in total submission to it, as the faithful and obedient believer ought to submit to the will of God. Now, Maximus was concerned to address an issue that monotheletism had raised, that two wills would mean an internal conflict in Jesus that would be difficult to resolve. Maximus said that there was no reason to assume that Jesus' human will would be at odds with the divine, since he was without sin. Indeed, the Gospels repeatedly convey the idea of the human will of Jesus submitting to the divine. All this means that Jesus embraced the fullness of our humanity. He held nothing at bay in his experience of being human and taking our place. So when he died, it accomplished our complete salvation. 20 years after Maximus was martyred by a pro-Monothelite emperor, the Third Council of Constantinople adopted his position on the cooperation of Jesus' dual wills. The creed that the council produced says this, quote, "His human will was lifted up by the omnipotency of his divinity, and his divine will was revealed to men through his humanity," unquote. Now, one writer describes the important difference between the one will and the two will positions this way. Pyrrhus was a Monothelite. Maximus, as we've seen, was the leading Diophilite. Regarding Jesus' suffering in Gethsemane, Pyrrhus said that Jesus asking the Father to take the cup from him, you know, was really just giving expression to what a human nature that loves life and does not want to die would say. But Christ wasn't really asking the Father to spare him the cross, since that would mean that he was willing something the Father didn't. Instead, he simply empathized with how one of us would feel in that situation. But Maximus argued that Christ genuinely wrestled with the question of dying, but redeemed our disobedience in Eden by making human will obedient, even to the point of death. Now, Pyrrhus' position may appear to resolve some difficulties in reconciling Christ's divinity and humanity, but only by making the incarnation a kind of, well, sham, where the eternal Son takes on only a pseudo-human experience, like he's kind of play-acting a part rather than becoming it. Okay, so we've worked our way through 6 of what are known as the 7 ecumenical councils of church history. We've examined the councils and the creeds that they produced, although really after the first council at Nicaea in 325, each subsequent council claimed that really all it was doing was refining the verbiage of that original Nicene creed. Each claimed that it was merely an extension of the groundbreaking work of that first august council convened by the Emperor Constantine all the way back at the beginning of the 4th century. So it seems fitting that the last of the 7 ecumenical councils should come back to Nicaea 450 years later. But its work had little to do with the Nicene Creed. Now, the 7 councils are called ecumenical because they're accepted by both the Western Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox churches as normative and defining doctrine. Both the Roman and the Eastern churches held additional councils that the other doesn't recognize because, well, they were partisan affairs. Now, before we get to the 7th council, we need to talk a bit about a council that was held 12 years after the 3rd Council of Constantinople. In 692, the Emperor Justinian II convened yet another council in the eastern capital to finish some of the work that had been omitted by both the 5th and the 6th councils, notably some canons that needed addressing. And for that reason, this council is called the 5th-6th Council. Since that sounds silly, though, let's use Latin so it'll sound more scholarly. And voila, it's known as the Quinixit Council. It was attended by only 215 only Eastern bishops. Now, most of the canon work that was done at this council aimed at settling ritual differences and coming to a standard practice of discipline for the clergy. Now, since the council was attended exclusively by the Eastern bishops, of course, it was the Eastern practice that was approved at the expense of those in the West. Now, the council condemned the custom of, are you ready for this? The Armenian churches that used undiluted wine in communion. Oh no. They also banned clerical nepotism and the utterly atrocious practice of eating eggs and cheese on the Saturdays and Sundays of Lent. Wow. Several of the canons, well, they seemed aimed at provoking hostility with the West, with Rome. While the Orthodox Church accepts the Quinixit Council as legitimate, Western churches never accepted it as authoritative or in any sense ecumenical. I mean, how could it be when no Western bishops attended? Oh, there was a supposed papal legate in attendance. At least the record marks him as being there. But Rome says no such person ever existed. The council made him up to make it appear that the Pope's authority was included. The Venerable Bede called the Quinixit Council the reprobate synod. Okay, the Pope at the time of the council was Sergius I, and he refused to endorse the canons and was ordered arrested by the emperor and carried to Constantinople. But the city of Ravenna's militia thwarted the troops' attempt to seize him. Isn't all of this just Lovely stuff. Isn't it wonderful hearing about how loving and humble church leaders were back in those days? Now, this is what happens when church and state become aligned under the rule of frail, fallible human beings. This is what happens when those in authority fail to abide under it. One of the most important products of the Quinixic Council was the official establishment of what's known as pentarchy. A pentarchy was originally articulated in legislation that had been laid out by the Emperor Justinian I in the mid-6th century, but it was then included in canon law and the council, which ranked the ecclesiastical sees of Rome, then Constantinople, after that Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem, in order of authority and preeminence. Justinian linked the administrative authority of the church to that of the state. Rome was regarded as first among equals, but by the time of the Quinixic Council, Constantinople was regarded as New Rome and had achieved parity with Rome in terms of ecclesiastical weight. At least the Eastern bishops thought so. Rome in the West, not so much. And so they rejected the council outright. While the pentarchy was a technical reality due to Justinian's legislation, it had little weight in determining anything other than just one more point for the East and West to argue over. And that brings us to the Seventh Ecumenical Council, known as the Second Council of Nicaea, held in the year 787. In a word, it meant to deal with the use of icons. And since we dealt with the iconoclast controversy in an earlier episode, I'm just going to summarize it here. The veneration of icons was banned by the Byzantine Emperor Constantine V. His actions were endorsed by the Council of Hyrea in 754. But, you know how people are, whatever the ruler says, they're all happy to comply with, right? Especially when it comes to religious sensitivities and issues of conscience. Yeah, not so much. The iconoduals, that is, the supporters of icons, rallied and staged a protest that was nothing if not vehement. But the emperor stuck to his guns and kept the iconoclast policy in place. He vigorously enforced the ban and persecuted violators. His son, Leo IV, continued his policy, but died while he was still young. Leo's widow, Irene of Athens, then acted as regent and began a restoration of icon veneration. In 784, the imperial secretary, Tarasius, was appointed as the successor to Constantinople's patriarch, Paul IV. And not wanting to take charge of a fragmented church, he consented to become patriarch on the condition that icons could once again be venerated. But since a council claiming to be ecumenical had abolished icons, another council was going to be necessary to reallow them. Now, to make the council genuinely ecumenical, the Eastern Church realized that it had to include the Western Church, and so invited the Pope, whose name was Adrian I, to participate. He accepted, but showed his authorization of the council by sending legates as his representatives. He didn't go himself, he just sent his reps. Now, the council met in the Church of the Holy Apostles in Constantinople in 786. When iconoclast elements of the military sought to break it up, the government devised a way to get rid of them. They mocked up a bogus campaign and sent the troops to go deal with it. Once they arrived at their destination, they were surrounded, disarmed, and disbanded. The council was once again summoned to meet, but since the capital was still torn by iconoclast factions, they chose to meet in nearby Nicaea instead. The council met for their first session on September 24th of 787 with 350 bishops and their attendants. Patriarch Tarasius presided over seven sessions that lasted through late October. The main work of the council was to reinstall the veneration of icons in the worship of the church. Both the Eastern and Western churches endorsed the findings of the council, the last time that they would agree on just about anything. And that wraps up our four-part series on the councils and creeds and sends us into that era of church history that leads up to the Reformation. This is going to be a series now that I call The Long Road to Reform.